children's books entertain and educate at the same time? I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, I discuss that question with two authors of children's books, both from Illinois. Janet Rehecke is a prolific author of mostly nonfiction books for children. The topics range from history to one of her favorites, dinosaurs. Marianne Feinberg, known to readers as Marianne Malone, writes fantasy with a bit of history included. Her 68 Rooms books use a real-life art museum exhibit as a sort of time travel portal, sending her characters to different points in history. Two approaches to children's books on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and the subject today is children's books, with a conversation with two Illinois children's authors. They both write very different types of books compared to each other, but they also both have a component in common in that in various ways their books seek to inform as well as entertain. Later on in the hour, we'll be talking with Marianne Feinberg of Urbana. Her readers know her as Marianne Malone, the author of the 68 Rooms fantasy series. Right now, we're saying hello to Janet Rehecke of Elgin, and you're welcome to talk to her as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL, and you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Janet Rehecke of Elgin started out as a school teacher. She writes books that are commonly used in classrooms but can also excite children's curiosity on everything from zoology to history. And Janet, welcome to Focus.
I'm glad to be here.
Okay. I was wondering, how many books have you written?
I've published 119.
119 books?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I should be saying that you're writing books for younger readers. They're profusely illustrated, and,
yes,
and some of them are really for very beginning readers.
Yes, that's how you can do so many, is if there aren't that many words.
Well, how did you, I was impressed by just looking at a few of them, is how much ground they cover. For instance, I have one here which is written for kids in the primary grades. It's one of your dinosaur books, the, help me here, Gigantosaurus. Am I even pronouncing that right?
It's Giganotosaurus.
Totally wrong. Giganotosaurus. You know, when we were kids, this dinosaur had not been discovered yet.
And, that's correct, yeah.
But your book covers a fair amount of ground, and one thing I'm wondering, when you're writing a book for kids with a limited vocabulary, your space is limited, how do you decide what to leave in and what to leave out?
I'm always looking for the things that are, that the kids are going to go, oh, that's cool, and those are the things you want to leave in. And basically, you just sometimes have to make a choice and say, you know, what's the most important thing for the kids to understand, and that's what stays in. But it is very hard sometimes. I have a book that it's called the Children's Writer's Word Book that tells me the reading level of different words, and so sometimes I spend a lot of time making sure that the words I use are words that the kids are going to understand and be able to read. And so that's, you can spend an awful lot of time on one sentence that way.
Are you, as far as how far you can go, because you're writing a book here about a dinosaur that eats other dinosaurs, and I'm just wondering, how gory were you allowed to get, or did you have firm limits?
They didn't mention any limits to me. My own instinct is to not make it too gory, but the kids really like a little bit, because it's safe for them, because this monster is not going to pop up in their neighborhood, and so it's kind of, you know, the kind of scary that's safe, and you can go, ooh, but you don't really feel scared.
Speaking of scary but safe, I thought perhaps even more explicit than the dinosaur book, another one we came across was, and even the name, this is the Killer Animals series, published by Blazers, by Capstone Press. And the particular one was Scorpions on the Hunt. It is full of photos of scorpions doing a lot of things to very unfortunate insects.
That one was deliberately designed to appeal to boys. because they're the ones that are more likely to think that this is cool. And it does, yeah, it does give you, but again, it's still safe because they're not likely to run into a scorpion. And it's doing that to insects, not to people. And so it is, and it is, you know, a fact of nature that there is prey and predator. And that's actually one of the words they learn really early.
Janet, how did you get started writing children's books?
I always loved to write, even when I was a kid. In fact, the first story I ever wrote was a dinosaur story. And I always dreamed of being a writer, but I didn't think that ordinary people got to be writers. And so I would write and write and write during summers when I was teaching. But it wasn't until I attended a writer's conference where I studied children's book writing under Madeline L'Engle, who you probably know is, and she's passed away now. But
Madeline L'Engle was the author of A Wrinkle in Time and a lot of other books for children and adults, many novels tinged with science fiction and a hint of spirituality as well.
She was just amazing. She won 2 Newbery Awards, and just to study under her for a week was such a privilege. And she liked my writing, and she thought I was good. And
was this your fiction writing, or was this writing like
This was both. I was doing. I always write 2 different things at the same time. I'm usually working on a fiction piece and on a nonfiction piece at the same time. And so she thought that the way I put together words was a way to make things interesting and fun, and she really just encouraged me to try my hand at it. And so I thought, wow, if Madeline L'Engle thinks this, maybe I do have a chance. And then I just got lucky. that's the way I really think about it, is that I just got lucky.
How did you find your first publisher?
Well, I was very, very lucky. I had been teaching high school, and things were not going exactly the way I wanted them to go, and I thought, what else could I do? And so I applied for editing jobs at various publishing houses, and the Child's World Publishing House hired me. And they, I hadn't been there very long at all, and my boss said to me that she wanted me to put together a package that we could give to an author to write a series of books on dinosaurs. And I was a high school English teacher. I didn't know how to do that, but I didn't want to admit that. So I thought, well, what would an author need to know? I thought, maybe if I just did a sample manuscript. And so I wrote a sample manuscript and showed it to my boss, and she goes, Janet, this is really good. We'll just have you write them. And so that's how I published my first books. And then they won Best Children's Nonfiction that year. So I was off and running. So it was really, like I said, you know, that's through the back door. I didn't have to, you know, look for an agent, pound on doors, and throw things over the transom. That's how it happened.
Now, I'm wondering, the books that we're seeing here are mostly nonfiction. You do write fiction as well, though?
Yes. I've published just 2 mystery novels and a set of fairy tale rewrites, and that's all the fiction I've ever published. I love to write fiction, but apparently I'm not as good at it as I am with nonfiction, because I have had trouble getting that published.
Well, with nonfiction, I'm wondering, when you're talking about a book for kids, how do you do the research? Is it the same sort of research as you would do on the same subject for adults?
Absolutely. You don't read other children's books. Some people are not as careful as they should be about the facts because they think it doesn't matter. I read adult-level material. I go books. I read professionally published articles and everything I can get on that's just as scientific as I possibly can. I put a lot of time and energy into the research because to me it matters getting it right. I mean, kids trust anything that's in print, and that gives you the responsibility to get it right.
I'm wondering, and first I want to remind folks that this is Focus on WYLL, and we're talking with children's book author Janet Rehecky about her work. And in a few moments, we'll meet with another Illinois children's book author, Marianne Feinberg, Marianne Malone to her readers. She's the author of the 68 Rooms fantasy series. Our phone number, if you have comments or questions, 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I know the third book that I had a sample of your works is probably the most sophisticated as far as reading level is concerned, and that was part of the Scholastic Encyclopedia of Presidents series. It's a book on Ulysses S. Grant. Did you write more than one book in the President series for Scholastic?
I also did William McKinley.
Okay. Yeah, I was at one point skimming through this book and about Ulysses S. Grant, and I forgot for a moment that I was doing a show on children's authors, and it was like I was preparing to talk to a Ulysses S. Grant biographer, and I was thinking up questions about Grant, and I want to ask my question about Grant, if I can.
Okay.
How does a person who was so bad at business end up being so good as a general?
Well, it took some different skills. One of his things in the field was that he was very persistent, that he didn't let setbacks get him down. He was always certain that their side was right and that they would prevail. And he really knew, he'd been trained at West Point, and he really knew what he was doing. In business, he'd never been trained for that, and he was a little naive, and he trusted the wrong people. And so because he hadn't been trained in that, he tended to believe what other people told them, and especially if they flattered him. He was kind of subject to that because he'd had so much in his life that had hurt his ego. He tended to believe people who flattered his ego. And so he knew about military matters. He'd studied at West Point. He had an enthusiasm for it, and he did believe he was right. When he became president, though, he hadn't been trained for that job at all, and he really didn't know what he was doing, and he really trusted the wrong people. I think his intentions were very good. He really wanted to do the right thing, but he let other people kind of tell him what that would be, and sometimes they were seeking their own gain instead of the good of the people.
And that's all from your research for your book on Ulysses S. Grant for the Scholastic Encyclopedia of Presidents series. Now, as I was talking with Marianne Feinberg before the show about our memories of what kids' biographies were like when we were growing up, my memory of kids' biographies is that whoever they were writing about was probably just a hero through and through, and the stories were pretty much the biographies were pretty much structured as stories with invented scenes and invented dialogue. And I would say there's none of that in this book that you wrote about Ulysses Grant.
Yeah, those kinds of biographies still exist, but Scholastic is very firm that they want everything based on fact, and their editors are really good. The editor I worked with for the Grant book was just amazing. He did probably as much research as I did, and Scholastic is like, the very top mostly. I mean, there's wonderful, wonderful publishers out there, but they are the ones probably the most respected out there, and they really do make sure that everything they put out is quality and that they don't lead kids astray, and they realize that kids need to know about the real world. They're still seeking to inspire, but they do tell the truth about things.
Now, you're writing for what may be both a willing but also an unwilling audience, I'm guessing, because it's not just kids who pick up your book out of curiosity and interest, but maybe because they've been assigned to read that book, or they need to research a school paper about Ulysses S. Grant or scorpions, for instance. How do you keep that in mind in terms of how do you figure out how to keep a book from getting dull in a kid's eyes?
It has to do a lot with verb choice. You want your verbs to be very active and kind of interesting and not just blah. You vary the sentence structure. You look for the most interesting facts, whether the kid is picking it up out of curiosity or because they have to, you still want to engage their interest. That's the first goal, because if they're not interested, the rest of it doesn't matter. Working with Capstone Press is absolutely wonderful because their pictures are so great that entices the kid in. And so I love working with them as well because they provide just such an amazing support group with the kinds of photos and the illustrations. You've seen the Giganotosaurus book. I mean, aren't those pictures amazing?
How were those pictures made? Was that?
I believe they're computer generated.
Okay.
Yeah.
They have that sort of Jurassic Park look to them.
Yeah. They're just amazing. So, the picture. You know, I'm not under the illusion that my words sell the book. The pictures sell the books. But then it's up to me to keep their interest and to tell them things that they just go, oh, that's kind of cool. And I always bring my experience in fiction writing into the nonfiction because I'm still telling a story. It's a story that's real, but it's still a story.
Just one page, open at random, from the Scorpions on the Hunt book. Suddenly the scorpion grabs the beetle. The scorpion stings the beetle. The venom from the scorpion's tail stinger stops the beetle from running away. The scorpion tears the beetle into tiny pieces. This is far more fascinating than anything I got on what scorpions actually did or what any tiny creatures actually did when I was a kid. So I congratulate you on the scorpion narrative.
Well, thank you. Like I said, you can see there the verbs are very strong, and that's what you want to go for when you're writing.
Do you test these things out with kids to any degree? Are you able to see any reaction? I understand you do some presentations yourself in classrooms.
Yeah, the presentations I do are not really about my writing. It's more about what the kids can do. I'm trying to inspire them to be writers. And I don't really test my material out anymore. I've been doing it for a very long time. And so I kind of, I really kind of know what I'm doing. And so I pretty much have a good feel for what is going to work with the kids and what isn't.
I understand that you use magic in your presentations
yes.
with kids.
I get to do so many fun things. I get to play with dinosaur bones. I have a huge collection of dinosaur bones. And I get to do magic. I have a semi-professional standing with the Society of American Magicians. And I use magic as a teaching tool. When I do a magic trick, it illustrates a point about writing. Like when I'm talking about editing a manuscript, I have a plain, ordinary rope, and we cut out the bad word, and I cut the rope in half, and then we put in a good word, and, you know, you take out the dull, boring words, and you put in the good words, and then, of course, the sentence and the rope are back together as if they'd never been broken. And so it's a magic trick where I cut and restore a rope, but it also talks about editing and taking out the bad words and putting in the good words. And so it's really a whole lot of fun. I have about as much fun as a first grader most days.
Have you ever written about magic in any of
them? I haven't, and I've thought about that sometimes. When I'm around, you know, full professional magicians, I'm aware of how much I lack because they're just awesome, and usually they fool me as well. But I thought it would be fun one time to create a fictional detective who used magic, and but I've never had time to pursue that, but I thought it would be fun to do.
Well, I'm wondering, now, I see you also teach writing for at the college level. You're an adjunct professor at Judson University in Elgin. And I'm wondering, are there any lessons from writing for children that could be helpful for people who are writing for adults?
The research aspect, because I usually teach two writing classes each semester at Judson, and they almost always give me the research paper to teach. And so what I've learned about how to find sources, because I don't just Google things, I dig in and I find, you know, first-person accounts and diaries and all kinds of things that you wouldn't necessarily think of looking for. And so I'm able to help my students see that there's a broad variety of sources out there and that research is fun. And I hope that carries over too. In the writing, I try to be very organized when I'm writing for kids because they need that structure. And the same thing applies if you're writing at the college level as well. And so I stress organization when I'm teaching the writing aspect.
Okay. And are you working on something right now?
I am. I'm doing two more dinosaur books at the moment. They'll bring my total up to 36 dinosaur books.
And I understand dinosaurs are a particular interest of yours.
Oh, I love dinosaurs. I'm doing a Velociraptor book and a Triceratops book for Capstone Press, and they'll be out in 2014. And they're just, you know, I'm having a ball. Every time I get to do a new dinosaur book, I go, oh, goody, goody, goody. I'm just like a little kid.
How do you research a book about a particular dinosaur? Where do you go for your data?
Usually I'm looking at journal articles because that's where the most current information is. I get the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology and other books. By teaching at Judson, I have access to their database of articles. And so I use the database to search out what's being said and what's being done. And I found some interesting research where somebody built a mechanical velociraptor and studied the movement of the tail and figured out that if it were, you know, the velociraptor was very, very small for a dinosaur, maybe 3 feet tall. The one you saw in Jurassic Park was all wrong. But they thought, think it might have been able to climb trees, and that when it jumped out of the trees, it could flip its tail one direction or another and change directions, almost like those lizards you see flip-flopping all through the air. And they built a mechanical one and tested it with all the, you know, graphs and charts and things like that. And I just found that fascinating, to think of this dinosaur leaping out of the trees and flipping its tail this way to track down and land on top of prey. And it's just fun to read those articles and see the creative things the researchers are trying to figure out for us.
Well, I'll be looking forward to the book on that one. I understand now your own favorite reading includes, was it mystery and fantasy fiction?
Yes, yes. I am a huge fan of both. I just absolutely love both of them. My favorite author for mysteries is Joan Hess, who writes funny mysteries that make me laugh out loud. And in fantasy, there's so many favorites. I love Anne McCaffrey. I love, so many. It's hard to even think of them all. I'm a voracious reader. I am always, always, always reading.
Okay.
And I think that helps your writing when you read a lot.
And you're still working at writing on fiction. There is a series that you had started, I understand, was it Fantasy Works or was it Mystery for Children?
It was Mystery, the Red Door Detective Club series, yeah. I wrote the first two books in the series, and they were published, and they got good reviews. Booklist said they were exciting without being scary and good reviews, but it was a very small house. And though I wrote a third and a fourth book for the series, they sort of went under before they got published.
Okay, so unless you can find another publisher ready to take over the series.
Yeah.
Was there a particular theme or a hook to the series?
Yeah, it was a pretty traditional one where the kids, you know, formed their own detective club and they you know, worked together to solve mysteries. And I was trying to appeal to both boys and girls, and so I had a girl and boy working together. And then they got their best friends, each of them, to come in. So we had a group of four kids that were, you know, solving mysteries. The first one was about a supposedly haunted house that they discovered a secret room in and some missing money that had been buried there or hidden there for a long time. And so it's a treasure hunt sort of thing. It wasn't anything terribly unique, but I had a lot of fun writing it and trying to make the characters unique and stand out. The young lady in the book was kind of, you know, always making funny, sarcastic remarks, and the boy liked to tell jokes and things like that, and so they were, I hope they were interesting to read about, and I felt very disappointed when I wasn't able to write, you know, more on that, but I was so busy, you know, writing something else that I just kept going. I'm always, always writing, so that's, but I would like a chance someday to write mysteries again, and I would love to try my, well, actually what I'm working on now is a fantasy novel. Fiction, but it isn't sold, or it's just for, you know, hoping when I get it done that I might be able to sell it.
Okay. Well, Janet Rehecky, I wish you luck on both sides of the writing aisle, fiction and nonfiction, and thank you very much for talking with us on Focus today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. You have a website for your particular work. We'll make sure to connect it to our website, but I understand it's Janet Rehecky.com?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's Janet, Rehecky,
yes.
.com.
Yes, yes. It's not pronounced the way it's spelled. It's my husband's fault. He's half German. And in German, the I-E is long E. So that's why it's pronounced differently than it's spelled. So, but.
Well, Janet Rehecky, thank you very much for being on Focus today.
Okay, thank you.
And in a moment, we'll be talking more about writing children's books with Marianne Feinberg. But right now, it's time for a short break here on Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. My guest on this second half of the show is another Illinois writer of children's books, Marianne Feinberg of Urbana, known to her readers by her maiden name, Marianne Malone. And her children's adventures center on the magical powers connected with the 68 Thorn miniature rooms at the Art Institute in Chicago. And I should note that the Thorn rooms are a real exhibit at the Art Institute in Chicago. I've seen them. The magical powers, perhaps conjectural. Her third book in this series is called The Pirate's Coin. The entire series is published by Random House. And Marianne, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
And you write a series, Your Child Heroes Rely on a Real-Life Museum Exhibit, which allows them to essentially travel through time. There are some special effects here, but they can travel through time and space to visit various parts of the world at different points in history. How did you get this idea?
Well, that's a great question. How does anybody get any of their ideas? I actually have always loved the Thorn Rooms. I grew up in Chicago. That was my home museum, and I knew about the Thorn Rooms from before I can even remember. So I used to take my students there on field trips when we would go to the city. I was teaching at Campus Middle School for Girls as the art teacher, and we would go there, and I saw over, you know, the decade that I taught, kids still really, really love those rooms. They just spur their imagination.
A certain dollhouse quality. It's a room that they can... It's little.
There's
something about it being little.
I think little is fascinating to everybody at all ages. You know, think of model trains. There are artists today who work in the field of miniatures. There's something about how you can control the world when you see it that small. I think that's what it is.
And the history of these rooms, Mrs. Thorne, I'm sorry I've forgotten her first name.
Narcissa.
Narcissa Thorne was a woman from a household of means.
Yes.
And so she had the ability and the income to pursue her hobby of creating these miniature rooms. She worked with an amazing group of craftsmen and women who were able to do this sort of work of rooms done to scale and also to historical accuracy.
Exactly. She wanted to create period rooms because at the time, this was in the 1930s, museums were creating historic rooms full size. There's a whole wing at the Met for historic rooms. Now, that takes up a lot of real estate, and she realized you could do far more rooms if you did them small. And she was a big collector of miniatures. She loved miniatures. So she thought, well, we'll just do it. We'll do them all and we'll do them small. So that's what she did. She set out to make 100 rooms, which she did. 68 of them are housed in the Art Institute now.
And again, and meanwhile, your book and your idea, how did that spring up?
Well, as I said, I'd been taking my students there. My middle daughter, was in college then, and I went to visit her one weekend, and I noticed that she had on her college bookshelf in her dorm room a copy of the miniature rooms catalog, the Thorn Rooms catalog. And she said, sometimes when I'm really stressed out, I just like to thumb through the books, Mom. And I was kind of floored by that. And so it was percolating in my head how interesting the rooms still were to me and to many people. And I took a nap one day after teaching, and I woke up with the idea in my head. So it was kind of magical.
The going from the idea to actually writing the book, you hadn't written books before, had
you? No, I'd never written a novel before.
But I take it you had enjoyed a lot of books and a lot of children's books as well when you were a kid.
Well, yeah, and mostly I rediscovered them when my own children were young. I reread them with a kind of sophistication as an adult, and I realized what great literature these books were. So they were elevated in my mind, kids' books. When you read them as a kid, you read them and you love them, you remember them, but you don't think about how fine they are. And so I had a new respect for them as an adult, and I thought I would really like to try doing that.
And it sounds like it must have seemed like quite a challenge, knowing the high regard you have for children's books. What was it like writing the first one?
Well, it was a very surreal experience because the story just poured out of me. I think you've heard authors, we've all heard authors say that, that they had this idea and it just poured out. Some books are hard to write and some books are as though you're possessed. And it was sort of like this. I sat down and in 3 months I had a first draft written and it needed lots and lots of refinement, but I'd gotten the story out very, very quickly. Came out of my head to the page quickly. The other books have not come that fast.
And that's that is interesting. The other books, besides The 68 Rooms, Stealing Magic is the second book, and the latest one, The Pirate's Coin. And what was it like going back, revisiting the characters you created for the first book, and developing them more and finding more for them to do in the second and third?
Well, it was really fun. As I started the first book, it came to me as a book, but 30 or 40 pages in, I realized, oh, wait, there are far more adventures that these characters could have. So I was very grateful when Random House asked me to write more. I knew there were more things I wanted Jack and Ruthie to explore. And there was something that Janet said in the last segment, that it can be scary but safe when you're writing for this age group.
Well, that's one thing I was wondering. Your main characters, Jack and Ruthie, they're in sixth grade. They are, what, 10 years old then? 10 or 11?
10 or 11.
10 or 11. And what you have them do is there's a magic key, and they hold the magic key, and they actually shrink down to the size of the rooms, and they open the rooms, and the rooms, instead of being just a model, are actually that room in that time and place.
Exactly.
And they can go outdoors from there and meet people and have adventures. But they're 10 or 11 years old. How much danger do you feel comfortable putting your characters in? And is that something that's changed from book to book?
Well, I've ramped up the danger with each book because there's time travel involved. And time travel creates all kinds of dangers if you don't know what you're doing with it. So I get my characters in more dangerous predicaments, which I think is really appealing to children. They want to test out the dangers of the world in fantasy. So I think that's important. By the end of the series, which will be the last book, the fourth book, they really get themselves in a very precarious predicament and have to figure out how to get out of it. So That was really important to take my readers on that journey.
Okay, we're talking with Marianne Feinberg, Marianne Malone to her readers. She's the author of the 68 Rooms fantasy series. If you have a question or a comment, call us at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll free, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And the fourth book is going to be the final one.
Probably. It was a four-book contract.
Okay, because you know these series can... Are you going to do some sort of plot detail which sort of locks everything off and ties everything up in a bow, or are you
going
to leave a little...
It's a very nice ending for my two characters, Ruthie and Jack. However, my agent kept telling me, don't kill the magic, don't kill the magic. So there is a loophole.
Okay. I know how... I've seen how children's series can go, and they can really take on a life of their own, sometimes surviving their authors, for that matter,
right.
And going into future decades. This third book... As from what I understand, it actually picks up on some events in the second book. Was that planned?
Yes, that was planned, exactly.
Okay.
And the same with the fourth book. There's a lot of interweaving of plot moments that come back, characters in book two and three come back. So,
okay. I'm wondering what books, you know, when you're writing these, do you have any particular children's authors that you draw inspiration from?
Well, there are a lot of wonderful children's authors who write historical fiction, not so much fantasy historical fiction the way I do, I guess. But of course, the obvious one is The Magic Treehouse, but that's for a younger demographic. a big, big series of about two kids who find a treehouse that takes them back into historical periods.
That was interesting. I was talking with our intern, Sari Laskin. Apparently, the Magic Treehouse played a big role in her childhood.
Yep, but not in mine and not in my children's, because that series came out, I think, about the time that my youngest child would have been reading it, but he didn't. So I found out about them actually after I really wrote my first book.
Okay, were you impressed by them?
Yeah, they're good. They're really good, yeah. So Laurie Hulse Anderson writes great historic fiction about the American Revolution and other eras. Jenny Holm, a great, great writer who writes books they're based on her family's history. They're set in the Depression. A wonderful book called Turtle in Paradise she just wrote was a Newbery Honor. There's great historic fiction for kids.
Well, that raises an interesting question, because on one level, these books are fantasy. The part about shrinking down to the size of these dollhouse-sized rooms and traveling through time is fantasy. But once you've traveled through time, then you're in history.
Exactly.
And that, I take it, takes a certain amount of research due to your satisfaction.
It does. I love doing the research part. I was an art history major, so I have a pretty good basis in Western history. But it's fun. You know, I get to poke around and find little interesting tidbits of things I didn't know about. I do a lot of fact-checking. You know, what years was Benjamin Franklin really in France before the Revolution? You know, you got to be accurate about that. And I know a lot of teachers use my books as jumping-off points for, you know, to get the kids interested in history. You know, I talk about the Salem witch trials. I talk about the period in the South before the Civil War. You know, I go to 18th century England a couple of times. So I hope that kids read these as exciting fantasy adventures, but realize that, wow, there's exciting adventures in history.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, I'm making a mental comparison between you and our other guest, Janet Rehecky, who writes, the bulk of her work is strictly nonfiction, but again, carefully researched, and she tries to go beyond secondary sources a lot of the time. I don't know how far deep you're getting into, but I think part of the challenge is just trying to figure out how to present the feel of a certain time and place.
True. While I was writing The Pirate's Coin, I read a book called The Age of Wonders, by Richard Holmes, I think is his name. And that's a history book about how the Romantic writers were influenced by the scientific discoveries of the late 17th century. And it gave me a flavor for what that was like. I read a biography of a woman named Emilie du Châtelet, who was the lover of Voltaire, but she was this brilliant scientist who could do calculus and was referenced by Einstein, you know, 200 years later. So I read a lot of history to get the flavor of the periods.
And by the way, just looked up the book you were referencing, The Age of Wonder, The Romantic Generation, and the Discovery of the Beauty and Terror of Science by Richard Holmes. I'm hooked already.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Now, in The Pirate's Coin, of course, there's a plot line. If you just start reading the sample on your Amazon page, in which you find out that Jack, one of the two children in the book, is actually descended from pirates. They know this, that he's descended from a pirate. Mm-hmm. And researching a pirate life and figuring out what parts you can show in a children's book, because some of them you might not want to go into too much detail about.
Right.
How did you figure that out?
Well, you know, they weren't all Johnny Depp in the Pirates of the Caribbean.
No, not quite.
So it's a fascinating story, what happened to people in those eras who found themselves in the pirate life. You know, it's not that different than what happens right now off the coast of Somalia. It was dangerous. They were desperate. And so I want to introduce the reality to kids of what that might have been like. So the character tells his story of how he became a pirate and how he stopped becoming a pirate.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with Marianne Feinberg, who writes as Marianne Malone, and she's the author of the 68 Rooms of Fantasy books published by Random House. The latest book, the third out of a projected four books, is The Pirate's Coin. If you have a question for Marianne, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Now, I'm wondering, you must have paid a few return visits to the Thorn Rooms over the past few years.
Quite a few.
Have you developed a sort of relationship with the folks at the Art Institute over your books and their rooms?
Well, I have. After I wrote the first book and after it was actually published, the woman who is the caretaker of the rooms is a lovely woman named McCann Morgan. She has been very helpful to me now and tells me lots of anecdotes about the rooms and the histories of the rooms. And she's, you know, I can call on her when I can't make the trip up to Chicago easily and I need to know a particular question about a particular room. So she's really helpful. She gave me a great anecdote about the, you know, some kids who were trying to get in the back corridor, which I have never been in myself. But she says this happens to her now frequently, that kids are going around in the rooms and, you know, pointing out the parts of the books that they the parts of the story, the rooms from the books that they recognize. I was there this weekend taking some friends' kids through the rooms on a personal tour, and a family came up to me. They had the 68 Rooms book with them, and they were so excited, and they recognized me, and I signed the book for them. And I often hear docents giving 68 Rooms tours for the public.
Okay. Let's go ahead and take a call and say good morning to Susan in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Marianne, it's wonderful to hear about this endeavor of yours. This is a former neighbor when you were on Michigan Avenue.
Yes, I recognize your voice. Hi, Susan.
Hi. And since I was a little girl and first came to Chicago from the East Coast and got to see the Thorn Rooms, I was intrigued, as you have indicated, many little girls and boys are now. And I think it's wonderful to hear that you've written this series to bring it to life and to bring it to attention, because I wondered when, it seemed to me they moved it in the Art Institute at one point from where I expected it to be, and it was in seclusion there for a while. And I
right.
thought, oh no, they're not gone, are they?
Now, this is the third location, actually, of the Thorn Rooms. The first one was before I was born. The second location was just over the railroad tracks under the stairs. That's the one I really remember from my childhood.
Yeah.
And then in the early 80s, they moved them to their present location. In fact, I have learned that there was a certain director who I won't mention a few directors back who wanted to get rid of the Thorn Rooms altogether. Because they're an oddity in the art museum. They don't really fit the general description of most curatorial departments.
No.
And so, but they did a study of traffic in the museum and discovered that the Thorn Rooms were the most visited exhibit in the museum, year in, year out.
How about that? Well, thank goodness they had the facts to put the director in his place.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much for doing this and for being on so that we know that you've done it.
Thank you, Susan.
Great.
Thank you very much for calling, Susan.
Yeah.
And that reminds me, the question with the Art Institute and that particular director's reluctance to have the Thorn Rooms there, was it because I guess they're a sample of decorative art? And maybe that's not a category that some fine art museums would feel comfortable with.
Well, the Art Institute has a decorative arts department.
Or is it just because they're little tiny rooms?
I think it's because they're little
they
tiny rooms.
Make people think of the Colleen Moore dollhouse in the Museum of Science and Industry.
Which is a very different thing altogether. And I think that the Thorn Rooms fit into the whole historiography of museums in a quite interesting way, aside from being enchanting. So I think now the Art Institute is quite proud of the fact that they have them.
That's good to hear. I'm wondering, you've talked about how you've upped the danger levels for your characters in the 68 Rooms books. As you've moved through the books, how have the characters evolved or developed? Do you know things about them now that you didn't know in book one?
Yes, in fact. I think that, you know, they recognize, it's sort of like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. What you think you want is not necessarily what you want, and you may already have what you really want.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Ruthie goes through that and discovers, you know, she starts out as a girl who's waiting for exciting things to happen to her, and by the end, she's stronger and braver, and also realizes that she can make exciting things happen, and it doesn't, and that she has a life that's really wonderful. So it's an old theme.
That's what's going to happen by the conclusion of book four.
Well, I won't give it away.
Okay. How far are you still writing the fourth book?
Fourth one is written. We're in copy edit. Almost, I think I'll have one more round of copy edit. It'll be out next summer.
Okay. You were not a writer until you wrote this first book in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
How has that changed your life, being someone who writes books, four books now?
Well, it's been wonderful. I still get to go into schools, which I really enjoy. I love talking to kids. And now I think all the time about stories. I have so many more in my head. I have a whole file of books ideas that I hope turn into books for, you know, fully. And so I'll keep doing it.
So you still want to continue to be a writer and a writer of books for children?
Yes.
What are children like as an audience, do you think?
Oh, they're wonderful. At least the age that I write for, say third through sixth grade, it's such a sweet spot. I really appreciate writing for them. You go and visit them in schools, and first of all, they know how to do school really well. They're competent. They know how to sit in an assembly. They know how to ask a question, and they're not jaded yet. They think it's exciting that you've come to their school. So I really appreciate it. And they have great ideas, and they inspire me. So I appreciate writing for them.
What has the writer's regimen been like for you? Because I know that's something that people have to do. You have to start at one point with essentially a blank page
right.
one point and fill it up with a book.
Yeah. Well, it can be daunting. I'm very careful not to think too much about how many pages I have to fill. Each day I think about the characters, and I never stop a writing session without giving myself a little hint of how I will start the next writing session the next day. Actually, the hardest part is the physical nature of writing. I find, you know, Margaret Atwood says when people ask her, you know, tips for writing, she says back exercises. I find it really hard to sit still that long. It's physically fatiguing, so you have to be careful about that. I have to get up and move a lot.
Are you someone who does a lot of writing out or thinking out main themes in their head first, or do you do it with the page in front of you or the screen in front of you?
I do a lot of it in my head first, and I really am a firm believer that my unconscious is always working on it. And if I'm open to sort of free association, my characters will give me the answer for where they need to go.
Are you working on another book even mentally at this point, or are you giving it a
yeah,
rest?
Yeah, I have about three mentally going on
oh
right now.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, but with that, mental work is also actual work on the screen. So,
okay. Is this something, when you were younger, did you have dreams of perhaps being a writer, even if you thought they were dreams you were not going to fulfill?
No, I really didn't see myself as a writer. I always saw myself as an artist first, always. And to me, there's not that much different. Once I get an idea, I want to see it real. I want to see it made. So whether it's a painting, a drawing, you know, a rearrangement of my garden, I want to make things. So to me, writing is really about making my ideas become real.
And I should note, all these books are illustrated.
Yes.
You've been working with Greg Call,
yeah.
throughout the series. And what's that been like?
Well, I've never met him.
You still haven't met him.
And that's very often the case for authors and illustrators. You are assigned your illustrator by the art director at your publishing house, and they try and keep you very separate because I think a lot of authors would probably drive their illustrators crazy with, do it this way, do it that way, let's do this. So the art director really directs the show on that. I do get input. Mm-hmm. And I have, at the end of each book, had a nice email conversation with him. He seems like a lovely man, and he is certainly very, very talented.
I thought perhaps the reason the editor would keep you apart is they were afraid that you would band together and ask for more money.
That too.
Well, we're out of time, I'm afraid. We've been talking about children's books, first earlier this hour with Janet Rehecki of Elgin, author of more than 100 books about mostly nonfiction subjects, everything from presidents to killer dinosaurs. And right now we're just wrapping up talking with Marianne Feinberg, Marianne Malone to her readers. And she's author of the 68 Rooms fantasy series published by Random House. The third book of The Pirate's Coin is out now. The fourth book and perhaps the final one. Do you have a title that you can tell us?
It will be called The Secret of the Key.
The Secret of the Key. Watch for it. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. That's at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show was produced by Sari Lesk and Lindsay Moon with help from Scott Cameron filling in. Jason Croft is our technical director. Tomorrow on Focus, everyone old enough to do so is looking back these days. 50 years ago, when President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, we will talk things over with former Life magazine editor Richard Stolle, who covered many of the events surrounding the assassination, and that's on Thursday's program. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10, a replay at 8 p.m. This is Focus on WILL.